Well, it's not just because of your vicar that I'm going to begin with a joke about rugby. I thought I'd tell you it was a joke in case you didn't get it. Joe is dying, and his lifelong friend Mike is at his bedside. And Mike says to Joe, he says, "Joe, we've been friends all our lives. We've played rugby together since we were at school, then at university, then in the club, and we went on till we were veterans, and we've played for years and years, and it's been great. But when you get to heaven, do you think you could let me know whether there's rugby there?" "Sure," says Joe, "I'll do that if I possibly can." Well, it's only a few days later, and the final whistle sounds for Joe, and he passes on. Midnight, 2 days later. Mike is awakened from his sound sleep. "Mike, Mike, it's me, Joe. Joe, where are you?" "I'm in heaven, and I've got some really good news and a little bad news." "Tell me the good news first," says Mike. "The good news," Joe says, "is that there is rugby in heaven. Better yet, all our old friends are here. Better yet, we're all young again. Better yet, it's always springtime. There's no snow, there's no rain, there's no mud. The games are wonderful. We can play rugby all day, and we never get injured, and we never get tired." "Fantastic," said Mike. "So glad you let me know. What's the bad news?" "You're in the team for Tuesday." Well, I like that story. The well-known philosopher, Professor Joad, was once asked who it was that he would most like to have met and what he would have said to them. And his answer was this. He said, "I would most like to have met Jesus and to have asked him this question: did you or did you not rise from the dead?" And the importance of the question can't be overstated, not just because you want to know whether there's rugby in heaven. Because if Jesus did rise from the dead, then he did something which is so outside human experience that it validates his claim to be beyond human understanding and different from ordinary mortal humans. And his claims about himself and what his life and death mean then have to be seen in an entirely different light. As a lawyer, I'm used to looking at evidence, and I weigh it up to decide what is true. A lawyer hears what witnesses say, he gauges their credibility, he looks at the evidence on the other side, he assesses it, and he draws inferences. He comes to conclusions. And what I say when I'm addressing jurists is this. I say, you're entitled to draw inferences. And what I mean by that is that you can come to common sense conclusions based on the evidence that you find to be reliable. And if you think about it, an historian does pretty much the same. He looks at the records of what people said at the time and later. He sees what all the documents say, and he puts them together to come up with a picture to write the book or whatever it is he's going to produce. And what we're looking at today is actually an issue of history. And it's really no different from any other issue of history, except that it's an extraordinary issue of history. But really what I'd like to do to start off with is to grapple with the question of how you look at the gospel records. But before I do that, I'd just like to ask you this question. If you were to think of someone of the same sort of antiquity who was on this earth around the same sort of time, who would you pick? And you might well come up with Julius Caesar. There's a famous figure for you. And does anyone doubt these facts about Julius Caesar? He fought wars in France. He came to Britain, 55-54 BC. He goes back to Rome with his troops. He crosses the Tiber. He goes into Rome. He becomes emperor, and he's assassinated. And the question is, how do we know? How do we know that? what's our knowledge based on? Well, I could tell you that about 9 or 10 manuscripts that you can now look at, all of which date from some 900 years after Julius Caesar's death, that tell us about those events, and they record things that other people have said at earlier stages, or are copies of what people have said at earlier stages. And that's how we know about Julius Caesar. 9 or 10 manuscripts, 900 years after the event. Compare that with how we know about Jesus. We have far more numerous manuscripts. We have a record, you can see it in the British Museum, all the Gospels, all the New Testament, that dates from 130 AD. There are 25,000 manuscripts which bear witness to the New Testament documents in their current form, all of which predate any of those documents about Julius Caesar. And the originals from which those documents were copied, all serious scholars say, were written in the lifetime of people who knew Jesus. Or at least arguably so. Most scholars who've studied this say they're around 60 to 70 AD, something of that kind. My own view, in fact, is that they're earlier than 70 AD, than the fall of Jerusalem, because no one in the New Testament ever says, Jesus predicted it, and it's happened. And if you were setting out to show that Jesus was who he said he was, the one thing you would do, if you knew he'd predicted something which had come true, you'd say it. It's happened. And they don't. And that's always seemed to me a compelling argument for thinking that the documents come into existence before that. Now, allow, if you like, for the fact that these documents are written by followers of Jesus. You've still got to approach them as records of what people at the time of Jesus are saying about what he did, what they saw and what they heard. Approach them as you would any other historical record and give them the weight that is to be accorded to evidence of that kind. And what you can't do, if you're open-minded and rational and objective, is simply to dismiss them on the basis that dead men don't rise, there is nothing beyond the material, or the events are so extraordinary that we simply can't give them credence because they're outside anything that we've experienced. Consider the evidence. There are records here to which nothing else in classical antiquity compares. There are records here to which no other religion and no other religious figure can compare. So let's just look for a moment at the accounts that were given at the time. The rival views as to what actually happened in 28 to 30 AD. And a big point that I want you to take away tonight is simply this. There is no doubt that on the Sunday morning, the tomb of Jesus was empty. No doubt. Why do I say that? Well, I say it for this reason. Because those who became followers of Jesus, they said that. But more to the point, those who were trying to stamp out Christianity, who wanted to squash this heresy, they agreed that the tomb was empty. In Matthew's Gospel, we find that the version of events that those who were opposed to Jesus were putting about was that his friends had come and stolen the body. The disciples had taken it. There was no body in the tomb because it had been stolen. Matthew says that's the story that the chief priests were putting about. That, he says, is the story they're still putting about as I put my pen to paper, or my quill to papyrus, or whatever it was, some 30 years perhaps after the event. And do you know, if you go to a debate in 160 AD between a Jew on the one hand and a Christian on the other, Justin and Trypho, you'll find that's still the argument that was being put forward by the Jews at that stage. Everybody who was in a position to know knew that the tomb was empty. And that's very significant, isn't it? Because today, when people put forward other possible explanations, they have no real validity at all. Because no one at the time would have given them a moment's notice. They would have had no credibility at all. If the body had still been in the tomb, it could have been produced. The Romans would have wanted to produce it. The Jewish leaders would have wanted to produce it. They would have wanted to get rid of this silly story that was going round. But they didn't. Had they done so, end of story. If Jesus hadn't died, people would have said it at the time. But it wasn't a realistic possibility. And no one did. So let's just look at the gospel records. Take them at face value just for the moment. What happens to Jesus? He's flogged till his flesh is laid bare. He's brutally beaten up by sadistic soldiers having their bit of fun. And he's taken out to hang on a cross. He hangs there for several hours. Many of you probably remember Mel Gibson's film. Remember The Passion of Christ? Very bloody, very brutal, but pretty realistic. Jesus can't actually make it out to his execution spot, carrying the crossbeam of his cross. They have to co-opt a spectator to carry it for him because he keeps falling over. And there, just outside Jerusalem, he's crucified. This is a form of execution that was designed by the Persians originally, then taken over by the Greeks and then by the Romans. And we know a bit about it because skeletons have been dug up outside Jerusalem that show the damage done. Nailed through the wrists, usually, to the crossbar. And then nailed through the ankles to the upright, usually by turning the ankle sideways, so it's one nail through both heels, effectively, or ankles, into the upright. Legs sometimes broken, the point being that this was to be a long, slow, painful death. Not by loss of blood, but by asphyxiation, so you couldn't breathe. Because what you have to do is to pull yourself up to breathe. And of course, if you've got no leverage on your legs, that becomes increasingly difficult to do. So that when they wanted to finish people off, they often broke their legs just to finish it. But several hours on the cross, and that was a sign to all those who opposed Rome that you ought not to do just that. And if they wanted to, they could always use a weapon to make sure you were finally dead. We know from the record we have, they don't need to break Jesus' legs because he's dead already. They stick a spear in just to make sure. They're clear he's dead. And when two people come to Pilate and say, the governor, the Roman governor, say, can we have the body? He wants to make sure. So he gets the officer in charge of the execution squad in and asks him, is he dead? And the officer says, yes. And the body is released to two of his followers. So they were clear, weren't they? They were clear in their own minds that Jesus was dead. We've got here soldiers who are part of an execution squad. Their job was to kill people. Not a difficult job to make sure someone was dead. And they did so. And I suggest to you that any suggestion that the Roman soldiers, trained executioners, were incompetent and failed to kill their victim lacks any credibility at all. A moment of light relief. This is supposedly a true transcript of the examination of a pathologist by an American lawyer. The attorney says to the pathologist, before you perform the autopsy, Did you check for a pulse? Witness: No. Lawyer: Did you check for blood pressure? Witness: No. Lawyer: Did you check for breathing? Witness: No. So then, is it possible that the patient was still alive when you began your autopsy? Witness: No. How can you be so sure, doctor? Because his brain was sitting on my desk in a jar. Lawyer: I see. But could the patient still have been alive nonetheless? Pathologist: Yes, it's possible that he could have been alive and practicing at the bar. Let's turn to the gospel records for the burial. Jesus is put in a tomb in a private burial area. The tombs, you can see them still today, hewn out of the rock, a cave, an entrance about 4 or 5 foot tall, something of that kind, and inside a chamber, usually with shelves on the side and sometimes an antechamber as well. And the hole, the front of the cave, is then sealed by a large stone, either like a stopper or like a great millstone. And there's a groove which runs downwards so that the millstone can run down the groove to the bottom of the groove and sit against the hole at the front of the cave. There'd be a wedge to hold it in place at the top. You could take the wedge out and down it will roll. If the entrance is about 5 foot tall, such a stone would weigh about 1.5 tons. Hard to remove. And the usual form of Jewish burial procedure we know too. The body would be placed on one of these shelves with its feet towards the door, and the body would be washed, and the nails would be cleaned and then cut, all the while the Jewish people saying prayers and reciting verses of Old Testament scripture. And the body would then be prepared with aromatic spices. We're not talking about an embalmment, it's not like an Egyptian mummy or anything of that kind. All the spices are there to do is to allay the stench of decomposition. They're not going to preserve the body. Nicodemus and Joseph, who are the two followers of Jesus who've got the body, we're told they have 75 pounds of spices, which is a lot of spice. The limbs are straightened out, and the corpse is clothed in white linen vestments, which are wrapped around. Two, possibly three different vestments, certainly two, because we know the headpiece is separate. And the spices are ground into a powder, mixed with aloes and myrrh, gum taken from a tree. And this would be placed within the folds of the different wines of the vestment. And the effect of this would be to stick the linen bits together and stick the linen to the body. That's broadly what you could expect to have happened. And then there's the guard. The chief priests and the Pharisees go to the Roman governor on the Saturday and they ask for a guard to be placed over the tomb. Pilate says yes. The guard is put in place and the tomb is sealed. A guard unit in the Roman army would consist of 16 people ordinarily, each trained to protect 6 feet of ground. I'm sure you've seen many films about the Roman army. They've been very popular of late. But this is no dad's army. These are trained professional soldiers. When on guard at night, there would be 4 men who are awake for 4 hours at a time on duty. And the other 12 would sleep in front of them in a semicircle, with their heads pointing inwards to the place they're guarding. So that anybody who wants to get to the door has got to tread through 12 sleeping people before they get close to the 4 who are actually on duty for the relevant 4-hour periods. punishment for deserting your post as a Roman soldier or for falling asleep was death, burned alive with your own clothes used as the kindling. If it was unclear who was responsible, then in the Roman way they'd cast lots, they'd throw dice, and the unlucky person took the blame. And a seal would be used, a piece of rope across the front of the door with a wax imprint on either end with the Roman seal impressed upon it. And if the seal was broken, because Rome's authority was at issue, that would bring the equivalent of the Roman MI5 down to investigate. And the person found responsible for that? Upside down crucifixion. Well, this is what we can take it essentially would have happened so far as Jesus and his body was concerned. But come Sunday morning, what do we find? The seal's broken, the stone has rolled away, the tomb was empty, and the grave clothes, sticky, spicy, are lying there separate. The piece round for the head has been folded up neatly and is in a different place. The guards, never punished. In fact, they're paid off to tell a story about what has happened. And many people then claim to have seen Jesus alive. Different in appearance, undoubtedly, in some ways, but nonetheless distinctly and identifiably Jesus. So where's the fabrication? The priests were absolutely determined to stamp out Christianity. Stop this heresy. What they said happened was that the guards had fallen asleep and the body had been stolen by Jesus' friends. I've always rather relished the prospect of cross-examining guards of that kind. You fell asleep? Yes. How is it that you can tell us who it is who stole the body? But the idea that four guards on duty for 4 hours are all going to fall asleep at the same time is hard to credit, isn't it? Particularly when you bear in mind there was a small earthquake. They were all trained Roman soldiers, as were the other 12. And so you have to imagine, for this theft argument to run, disciples walking through 12 sleeping bodies noiselessly, past the sleeping four who are supposedly on duty, rolling the stone back noiselessly, entering the tomb, and then taking time to unwrap the body from all the sticky windings, leaving one piece at least in one place and another in a different place, picking up the body, carrying it out past the sleeping guards once again, and disappearing into the night with it. And then starting a story about a resurrection that they knew to be a complete lie. One of the things I do when I'm dealing with evidence is to look at the reliability of witnesses, to work out whether someone is likely to be telling the truth or not. Are they being honest? Are they being accurate? And when you examine the people who are telling this story, we find that they are followers of Jesus, for whom truth and honesty and integrity are key matters. And the very first witnesses, the people who actually are recorded as seeing Jesus being taken from the cross, Jesus being put in the tomb and the empty tomb, who are they? They're ladies. Ladies whose evidence wasn't even admissible in a Jewish court of law. And if you're inventing a story, the last thing you do is have ladies as the first witnesses. But of course, we have a succession of people. We read about them just a moment ago. We have Mary Magdalene, we have the other Mary, we have Salome, we have Peter, we have James, we have two on the road to Emmaus, we have the 10 disciples in the upper room. Then the following week, we have Thomas with them again. We have 500 people at one time. We have a group on a mountain by Galilee. And so it goes on. None of these people are expecting it. Most refused to believe the first reports they heard. They thought it was just wishful thinking on the part of the ladies. And Thomas, we know, the ultimate skeptic, will not accept anything anybody tells him until he's seen it for himself. If there's a fabrication here, it's a very large conspiracy indeed, isn't it? It involves all of these people, some of whom had previously not been followers of Jesus at all. So, for example, we know from the records that Jesus' brothers did not accept him until after he had risen from the dead. His brother James, whom we know specifically he had a meeting with after he rose from the dead, becomes a leader of the church in Jerusalem. And what I suggest is simply this. It's psychologically improbable for a group who had been rendered desperate by what had happened. They were in despair that their leader had died. They were terrified that they were the next to be killed. For them to have done what is suggested, to steal the body, and then to fabricate a story of the kind that is suggested in the resurrection, defies belief. Within weeks, these people are giving an account of a resurrection for which they're prepared to die. You can forget mass hallucination. Something like 15 different appearances to individuals and groups are related in the Gospels. And what do they see? They see a figure that eats and drinks, a figure that makes breakfast for them and talks to them and explains what's happened, a figure who shows them his wounds for examination and invites them to touch him, and yet a figure who can come into a locked room without opening the door, a figure who's human but much more than human, different and more real than even solid physical things. And we have many people from all sorts of backgrounds, of all sorts of temperaments and personalities, who all meet him and say the same thing. So we have educated people, we have uneducated people, we have sensitive people, artistic people, we have rough and ready people, down-to-earth people, wide boys, professional people, fishermen, people from all walks of life. And they met Jesus, and it changed them, because they saw that it mattered more than anything else which had ever happened. It mattered to them personally, but it also mattered to the world as a whole. So, examine the evidence. Who's making up a story here? Whose story does make sense? What does explain the empty tomb? What does explain not just what those disciples became and the growth of the Christian church all round the world, but what also explains how it is that millions of people since say that they have met the risen Jesus in their own experience, and it changed them and their view of life too? An empty tomb is the starting point. The only logical conclusion, I suggest, if you look at the evidence objectively, is to see that a man has been raised from death. But obviously more than a man, God as man, involved in human life and death, as Jesus himself said he was, whose death and resurrection have cosmic and personal significance. If it's true, then we better listen to him. And we better respond to his claims on us. Thank you very much.
Jeremy, thank you. What I suggest we do is just take 2 or 3 minutes perhaps to chat to the people around us. And then if there are any kind of questions that come up from that, then there'll be a chance to ask those in a few moments. As I mentioned, if you'd rather not ask those out loud, then why not just jot it down on the bits of paper you got as you came in, pass them to the ends of the row, and we can get them passed up here as well. So just 2 or 3 minutes then to chat amongst yourselves, and we'll be back in just a moment. Okay, folks, so I'm going to just come down the aisles now. So if there are any kind of written questions, if you just send those down, I'll come and collect them now, and we'll have questions in just a moment. So carry on chatting for now. I'll just get the written questions. Okay, folks, so let's start with the questions that have just been written here, and then we'll have questions from the floor straight after that. So the question here is, Jeremy said that Jesus said he was fully human. How was he able to rise from the dead, be the Son of God, whilst also being fully human?
Well, you need to be a very clever theologian to answer that question. It's a mystery. We have God becoming man and being subjected to human limitations. but nonetheless being fully God. Fully God, fully man is the way Christian doctrine describes it. I can't explain that to you, but it is in fact the only logical explanation for who he was and what he did. How was he able to rise from the dead? Well, in fact, the way it's described is that God the Father raised him from the dead. And his death, being an atoning sacrifice for all our sins, is accepted by his Father. And he's vindicated by being raised from the death. It wasn't possible for death to hold him, we're told in one of the earliest sermons in Acts, because he was indeed the Son of God. And it said that God would not abandon his Son to the grave, to decay, to corruption. I think that's about the best I can do. I think if you want a better answer than that, you'll probably have to talk to Will or Sam here.
Don't talk to me, talk to Will. Okay, next question. Why did Jesus look different after the resurrection?
Well, then again, that's a very difficult question to answer. He undoubtedly did look a bit different, didn't he? Because people had trouble initially. And I think the answer to it is this, that he has a resurrection body that is different from what he had before. And we know that because, of course, as I mentioned earlier, he ate and he drank, but he came through walls, didn't he, effectively? His body was, in a sense, more real than the physical objects. I've just been reading about black matter and black particles. Anyone in the room know about these things? Apparently they exist out there and in space. And they're more solid, in a sense, than other material because they pass through them. Now, I don't understand that. And I don't understand exactly what form Jesus' body took. But we're told by one of his followers that when we rise from death, we will have a resurrection body like his. It won't be exactly the same as what we are now. It's a rather good thing in my case. But it'd be a glorified body. It'd be a transformed body. And that's what he had. And so in some respects, he did look a little bit different. But he nonetheless was very clearly the same Jesus. Again, I can't do any better than that. I'm sure there are others here who might be able to answer more precisely. Though in truth, I don't think anybody can give you a clear answer to that.
Jeremy,
do you want to try?
You. No, I won't try, but thanks for the kind of thumbs up. Any questions from the floor?
Now's your chance to ask any question that you've always wanted to ask a judge. Oh, he's a cop one. Yes. That's exactly a question someone asked at lunchtime today. I think the answer is they didn't know. Because when you read one of the Gospels, it said they were talking to themselves on the way. Who's going to move the stone for us? And I guess they hadn't thought this through very well. You know, they were very distressed. They were people terribly upset. They hadn't been able to do the anointing of the body they wanted to do before the Sabbath day off. And they were getting up early and going there first thing on the Sunday morning. And they hadn't worked it out. And when they got there, of course, it wasn't a problem. But it would have been a problem. They might have got the gardener to come and help them, but he'd have had been a pretty tough gardener if he was going to push a 1.5-ton stone out the way. I think I said at lunchtime Will might have managed it, but I'm not sure many others would. Yes. The question is, why is it that after 2,000 years with all this evidence, there are Jews who don't believe? Mouse, that is, why are there people all around the world who don't believe? And the usual answer is because they don't want to believe and are not prepared to look at the evidence. They're not prepared to take the gospel record seriously. So often, faith is not a matter of an intellectual problem, because I don't really think many people do have intellectual problems that stop them being Christians. What stops people being Christians is they know that if they believe, then their whole way of life is going to have to change. Because no longer are they going to come first, but Jesus is going to come first. That's what attracted me about the Christians that I saw when I was a young man. That they lived, not for themselves, but for Christ. And people are scared of that. They don't know quite what it's going to involve. It means giving up your self-will, doesn't it? It means handing your life over to Christ. And that's a scary thing for people to do. And so the main reason, I think, why people don't believe is exactly that. They don't want to believe. Yeah. I was asked this morning why it is that if this is such a compelling case, why aren't all my fellow judges Christians? And I gave exactly the same answer, because judges are no different from anybody else. There's a question of the will involved here.
So.
Well, you're touching on a sore area there, for this reason, that I was basically a fly half. I was a thinking person, you see. But every team that I ever joined, they already had an international fly half, or the skipper was fly half. So I spent most of my life in the centre. These days, I'd never survive. You know, they're all now 6'3" and 16, 17 stone in the centre. But in those days, we used to generally have one big, powerful centre who would take the crash balls, and then you would have one who was a bit tricky, you know, the speedy one who went in and out and had a nice sidestep. I like to think I was that one. So. Well, I think, as with all evidence, you have to look at it together. What you're always trying to do is to come forward with the most coherent explanation for all the evidence that exists. So I don't think I would separate out any particular piece as being the strongest. But the starting point, I think, is the one that I mentioned, which is, at the time, and these are the people who are around making the arguments, at the time there were only two potential solutions. And all the other things that people say now, nobody put them forward because they knew they just weren't credible. You know, ideas that Jesus didn't really die, that he went into a faint, that everybody had a mass hallucination, whatever. They just weren't realistic possibilities. The weakest piece? Well, the thing that most people will focus on, we had this in a debate in a school this afternoon, but the thing that people will focus on is undoubtedly the gospel records. And people will say to you, you can't rely on them. But the reality, as I hope I've demonstrated today, is that for any piece of history, you always have to look at the records of the people who were there. All evidence is about what people say they saw and heard. And the evidence in this respect is no different from that for any other matter at all, and indeed is far more powerful. For Jesus, than, for example, Julius Caesar or any other figure you care to take. So is there a weakness? If you want to, you could think of any number of potential other explanations. But if you ask at the end of the day, are they credible? Are they more likely to be true than the extraordinary fact of Jesus rising from the dead? My answer would be no, I just don't think they are. So did you want to ask something? It's been covered.
Yeah.
Right. Over at the back there, sir.
How difficult was it for you to get a question in your representation?
How difficult? You're different. Rugby teams, like any group of men, whether you're in the services or anywhere else, tend to behave in a particular way. You get a lot of drinking, you get womanizing, but an awful lot of that is chat too, rather than the reality. If you're a Christian, then you have to stand out and say that's not the way I go. I never had terrible trouble about that. People used to take the mick out of me all the time, pull your leg about it, give you a bit of stick. But as a Christian, if you believe you're living for Christ, then you live the right way and you stand up for it. And actually, most people give you a bit of begrudging respect for it. But a rugby team is no different from any group of men together. And the same thing you'll get in school or elsewhere, just slightly magnified, and they like to think they're slightly tougher. Yes.
I'm not I've done. So quite compelling evidence is, bar one of the disciples, as I'm sort of led to believe, all died in the winter grave, so that testimony that from here indeed died and rise again. But seven, well, yeah, there are people who die for their beliefs. The people are not going to die for things that they believe are not true, which I find is quite valid sort of evidence there.
It's quite a powerful point, isn't it? That if these people made it all up, and made it up from a time when they were pretty desperate people and frightened of dying, and yet within a few weeks they're prepared to put this account forward and risk death, and indeed go to death, as many of them did, it's a powerful point, isn't it? Yeah. Certainly. Can't answer that. Would you like to give an answer? You've got any ideas? The question was, if Jesus managed to walk through the wall, why didn't the wall fall apart? Because, I mean, the bottom line is the same point we were discussing earlier. We're talking about a different reality, aren't we, with a transformed body. It doesn't fit into our categories of physical matter. And whether you talk about another dimension or whatever, whether you talk about black particle, neither here nor there. But it is something that is undoubtedly different from the ordinary physical world in which we live. Sir? I'm sorry, I completely missed. All judges are deaf, you should know that. Why was the stone rolled away? Oh, I see. Oh, well, Jesus didn't need the stone rolled away to get out. The stone had to be rolled away so the ladies could get in and see what had happened. You're absolutely right. Jesus didn't need the stone rolled away in order to emerge from the tomb, quite clearly. But it was absolutely vital that the witnesses to the resurrection should see that the tomb was empty. Yeah, sorry. I apologize for my terrible hearing.
Jeremy, thank you. We're out of time. Oh, last question. Of course.
Yes, indeed. What we read of that is there's a small earthquake and the guards are effectively completely phased by it. And that's why, of course, the guards have to be paid off. That's why they don't get punished, because they have to be paid off to put forward the story that the disciples have taken the body. Yeah.
I'm sure many more questions. Jeremy is sticking around after, so if you want to talk to him personally, please do come and do that. If you'll just forgive me just for flagging up a few things just as we close. Jeremy did mention that the best thing to do if we're still weighing these things up is just to have a look at the evidence for ourselves. We've got these little copies of Luke's Gospel. It's one of the four Gospel accounts that Jeremy referred to. We'd love you to take one of these free of charge. They're on the table at the back. And perhaps over Easter, you can set yourself a little challenge of just taking one of these and reading through it. So they're for you there.